Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two sponsors for you. I'll mention here at the top of the show, Sublime Textbook. Literally, that's the URL, sublimetextbook.com. It's by Mr. West Boss. It's a book all about leveling up your abilities with our favorite text editor, Sublime Text. It's pretty awesome. And Harvest, getharvest.com is time tracking apps. And literally apps for your phone, for your desktop. They have apps for every platform and everything. And with that time tracking data, you can do so much stuff to keep track of your business, including what you do after time tracking, things like invoicing and stuff. That's getharvest.com. We'll tell you more about both those things later in the show, but for now, let's kick things off.
Hello, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front end web design and development. I am Dave Rupert, and with me is a soundboard. Oh, Chris Quare.
Yeah,
hey Chris.
I'm not as interesting or dynamic as the soundboard, but I help you co-host.
Shop Talk.
That's the best.
Shop Talk. Chris.
Nothing.
It's you. Me, soundboard. Who else is here?
Really, just IA writer with a markdown file open with a whole bunch of user questions that we are prepared to read and answer. No guests, no drama, no other things that take time. It is a rapid fire episode.
Oh yeah, bad rapid fire sound effects are back.
That's fantastic.
Oh, you've been waiting.
Yeah.
And this is, we should probably be totally transparent because we like to do that on the Shop Talk Show, but this is, we're hitting summer travels and blah, blah, blah. So we've got some rapid fires all queued up and I might have jury duty, so that's weird.
That's right. It'll be 50-50-ish rapid fires or higher. Possibly,
yeah.
In the share of rapid fire, because we are traveling a lot, but we've been pretty good about bringing you a show every single week. This one isn't even that far time delayed. I'm sitting in a hotel room in Boston right now. It's just at Event Depart Boston, and it was a pretty good time. But see the lengths we go to bring you this show. I had to pack this microphone up in my luggage, but brought less underwear just to bring this.
There's a tornado watch in Austin today, mm-hmm. So
Dave should be underground. You know,
probably. I'm risking my life for this show.
Idea is that we're going to answer as many questions as we can. I kind of pick them at random, ones that I think me and Dave are probably best suited for, and save the ones that are better for guests later. But, you know, but it's all, they're all front end-ish related. Nick sees. Writes in, I'm a bit confused about how a client can have remote access to a project during development, like before it goes live. What do you do? Do you like put it on a server that you host on an old PC in a closet somewhere? Do you buy web hosting just to host the development site? Or is there some kind of like free temporary hosting you can use? Or do you just like use GitHub somehow or what? So Nick wants to know, client wants to see what you're doing in the browser during development. How do you do that? How do you show them that stuff?
Well,
there's got to be 50 ways.
Yeah, 50 ways to lose your client. let's go classic is a staging server.
Let's go back and forth. You do one, I'll do one for 10 minutes.
Staging server. This is, you push it up to like staging.myclientdomain.com and it's a mirror of what will go live on the .com, right? So it could be whatever, some weird IP address or some, you know, like, but it's a either different folder on the server or a different server entirely that is a mirror clone of that server. That's one way.
Sure, and
that makes sense.
It does make sense, but what would the URL be? Well, that's up to you. It could be, like Dave said, if it's just a folder, it could be that website, you know, /new or something. That'd probably be a little weird because then the URLs would be like different and stuff. So it's probably more likely that it would be a subdomain that through DNS you point at wherever this new thing is, whether it's on that same server in a different kind of land or on a different server or whatever. Like for CodePen redesign, we're using a kind of secret subdomain that points to an entirely different server, but it's .codepen.io. And it's just so that we can share it with the agency that we're working with in that way. Now, that's a pretty, I don't know, standard-ish way to do it. And so you're saying, would you buy new hosting? Well, I guess you wouldn't necessarily need to. You know, when you buy web hosting, it doesn't mean that only one URL can ever be on that hosting ever. But you might buy new hosting just in case you want to keep things separate or whatever. You know, this all stuff is kind of up to you. There are ways, you know, and this is I don't know if you'd do that if you're just like a single person freelancer working on a WordPress site for a bakery or something. It seems like a little intense, although maybe not, you know, maybe it's fine. Mm-hmm. But in those kind of circumstances, what might you do? I think I've seen, you know, there's like, do you need it to be permanently up there or can you limit what you're showing your clients to time? Can it be like, okay, I'm gonna throw something up from my local host and use one of those cool like little portal things to make
local
it public?
Tunnel.me.
Is that a good one?
Me.
Sure. Yeah. I've seen a good 10 of these too, but they will show your local host on a real internet live, probably an IP address or some, I don't know what it gives you exactly. Maybe it's a little temporary throwaway URL. And then you show it to your clients and they can see it live, but then it just goes away when you kind of shut that tunnel down. So that's a possibility. Can you think of any other?
Well, so if they have technical know-how, the GitHub is a good one. So you commit your branch, your future branch, up to GitHub, and then they pull that branch and they bring it up on their local computer so that they can see it. That's like something else you can do. That's a pretty average, commonplace. Ideally, if you're working with a client that has development in-house or is technically savvy, you could do that as well. But it gets a little harder if you're using something like WordPress or something. WordPress probably has a lot of
caveats.
Yeah,
because it has some dependencies because there's PHP and MySQL and stuff that need to run there. GitHub, other than just the repository, if it's a static site, either just a static site all by itself or a static site generated by Jekyll or something, GitHub Pages is a way to do that. It's kind of free hosting, and you could show them that. You know, that would be a largely dependency-free thing though, right? Like GitHub won't run any backend code at all as far as their pages thing. But if it was just a static site, you could use that. Also in static site land, DivShot is pretty cool for that, right? They have a little drag and droppy kind of, but that also, there's no dependencies there either, right? It would have to be, actually, maybe there is. Maybe not. It's all they're good for, if the dependency is JavaScript, that is okay, because that's client side. Yeah. But no.
If you're using WordPress, I use this one called Theme Driver. Have you ever used that? It's like basically you do a query parameter like ? Theme equals new theme, and new theme will show up.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Okay. So it's like you use the live site, and then and the live site is the active theme is still the old theme, but you make a new theme folder, and then if it has this URL, special unique URL, it knows on the back end to serve up the new theme instead of the old theme. That's a great way to do it.
You can run into problems like if you wanted a special, I don't know, like if you need your data to be different, like all post titles have to be 28 characters and now, but there are 150 in the database. Like you're going to have problems, but it's a great way to test, like as you're developing.
Yeah, I
like,
could see that though. Like what about bad custom post types that are set in the functions.php file that are different between those two themes? How would that behave and stuff? I'm not sure. Maybe
which
it's
is
fine.
Maybe an argument for making that a plugin,
a development server. I would think that if you want to level up and do this the right way, you should probably go the route of setting up a temporary server to work on That seems like the most kind of tried and true, best possible way. Nick, good luck. Let's do another one.
I was going to say, I also have like Heroku. I have a blog post on my site. I do, I put a folder into Dropbox, and you can do that too if it's static. But I put a, I generate a site into Dropbox, and then it goes up over the web to, it syncs to Heroku over Dropbox, and then I password protected it. So like, so it's got a secret password that you have to enter before getting in. That's pretty good for me and my clients.
Classic like, to Dave fancy. You know,
hey,
love it.
It was like, I have created great magic. This is wonderful.
Didn't you blog that or not?
What's that?
Did you blog that idea? I can't remember.
I did blog it.
Yeah.
It's called we'll link to that, DaveRubert.com. Deploy a password protected Jekyll site on Heroku with Dropbox. It's basically like SEO town right there.
Yeah. Nailed the title. You're going to get
SEO.
5 hits a day from that, from people that really needed it, though, you know?
At least. In like, yeah, advertising bucks just through the roof. Almost as successful as Uncle Dave's old padded box.
Almost. That's a good one, though.
Anyway, so hopefully that helps, Nick. Like, try to keep it free, or I don't know. It's kind of in the $10 a month range to do it really well, probably. That's so it's not a huge hit to your business. But anyway, good luck with that. Chris?
Yeah, David Powell writes in here. What does he say, Dave?
I just started with a new agency and I'm leading in the entire team. I'm trying to push more CSS3 animation on HoverFX and not worrying about supplying older browsers with that animation. The team has used GreenSock.js to handle animations cross-browser. I argue that using a library like GreenSock is fine for large, complicated animations, but HoverFX and MinorFX should move to pure CSS3 in keyframes. Am I going overboard with this thinking, or should I back off and let the team continue with something like GreenSock?
So that's pretty interesting because neither one of you are wrong necessarily, right? Like, you have the more modern thinking here. And now let's just to talk about something real. Say there's, you know, some navigation and it's in green boxes at the top of your site. And when you roll over them, they fade to black boxes. Most of us here know that you could use a transition in CSS to do that. You put transition and then like 0.2 seconds or something. And then when the background changes to black, it will transition that color. That's absolutely doable in CSS3 and limited by the browser support for untransitions, which is extremely good, but to be fair, not like IE8, for example. So your team thinks, hey, that this is so, you have to kind of figure out the stakeholders of this project, you being one of them, but your team, and I don't know if there's clients that see the site or what the deal is, how important it is for green to fade to black in IE8. And it sounds like your argument is not very important at all, but somebody somehow else either disagreed or they just kind of automatically reach for tools like libraries to provide deeper support just because, I don't know, they read a blog post that it was a best practice. Yeah. I think that the fellows at GreenSock, who I talk with pretty regularly, would agree that using the entire GreenSock library to fade green to black is not a particularly good use of GreenSock. It probably will work. It solves the problem, but that's not what GreenSock is for, really. I mean, it can do that, but it's a big, robust library that I've only recently gotten a chance to like start building with and play stuff. But it's for like building timelines and doing really interesting kind of complex animations in like a very powerful, nice API. Not that you couldn't do some fairly simple stuff for it and exploit its ability for you know, making it work in older browsers. That's fine, but like green to black, even GreenSock would be like meh. You know, if it gets, you know, if it's to make a keyframe animation work older or something, yeah, definitely. It's a great library, but just using it for a tiny little ability to provide a little bit of fallback. CSS3 animations and keyframes are pretty darn well supported these days, you know? Anyway, and then like, what is your project already using jQuery? Because jQuery, you know, it's not like necessarily recommended that you use a lot of its animation stuff, but it handles animations as well. So if you're already using, for example, jQuery or something like that, you might as well just use that for it. If it's determined that IE8 is important, I wouldn't load both jQuery and GreenChuck just for IE8.
Yeah, the web performance dudes I follow, they kind of abdicate, not show hiding with JavaScript and doing more like class triggering, like apply a class, remove a class. Like JavaScript
show hide has been determined uncool in jQuery.
Yeah.
It's because it does some secret stuff. Like it remembers, if you take something that's display flex and hide it, dot hide it and then dot show it, it will remember that it was display flex, because CSS is weird and display none, there's no opposite of display none. It's like you don't know what it was before. I don't know if that's what makes it slow, but there's some behind the scenes stuff that kind of makes it slow. But I agree with them. Even if it wasn't a performance concern, I like the idea of changing classes anyway, because it's just you can do other things other than just display block and display none in CSS. It gives you a chance to, maybe fade the opacity out before you do it, or just kind of it keeps the display logic in the CSS where it kind of should be, and the state logic in JavaScript where it kind of should be. I just kind of like it anyway.
Yeah, that would be the purest, I think, version. And you're also like, does somebody have to wait for GreenSock to load to like see a hover button hover? It's kind of like CSS has been optimized to built now to offer these baseline animation, like simple effects. Like that's CSS's bread and butter. You get hardware acceleration, blah, 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 blah. Like I would just do that. Do that. Animations is a little tricky because like CSS keyframes is possible, but it's also kind of super hard. Like there's not, it's not, if you're doing a complicated animation, you want GreenSock. So, if you're flying every element of your page in as you scroll, that's probably GreenSock territory, but, or you doing like a fancy, I don't know, like somebody walks out onto the screen and gives a tutorial of your site.
Sure, if it's multi-step, multi-stage, or is SVG, because SVG has a bunch of weird animation bugs and it kind of normalizes those. There's lots of reasons to use GreenSock. It's a great library, but like I said, if it's super something very easy to do in CSS 3, I'm a little sick of saying CSS 3. It's a little cheesy. Let's just start saying CSS.
CSS, because CSS Next is coming. Whoa. All right. Pew.
Let's do a quick sponsor. We have GitHarvest sponsoring Let's Get to Work with Harvest. The URL is getharvest.com. It's a time tracking app. We've talked about them a little bit before, but time tracking is kind of the heart and soul of it. I like apps like this where like that's the main thing they do and they do it extremely well. But then it's like, what are all the extra cool things we can do now that you already do that with your business? Now you can learn about your business. You can see how you spend time and not just how you spend time, but presumably there's multiple people at your business. You can see how everybody is spending time, seeing if you're being efficient with your clients or how you can shuffle things around. You can by looking at reports that it builds from that time tracking stuff. There's invoicing that can be done. Oh, I see, we spent 32 hours on this project last month. We can bill for 32 hours. You can send an invoice right from Harvest to those clients, get PayPal because it's integrated with Stripe and PayPal and stuff. You can kind of use that data, now that you know more about your business, you can produce estimates right in Harvest to send to them. You can do your expense logging right in Harvest. It can kind of become this hub for kind of controlling what's happening with your business. And it works on the web, but there is a Mac app. There's a Windows app. There's an iPhone app. There's an Android app. There's a Windows phone app. There's a Chrome extension. There's a menu bar app for Mac that helps with the time tracking and stuff. It's a very robust app that's just been around a long time and is widely beloved by the community, including us. So the URL there is getharvest.com. Check them out.
Nice. All right. Blake C. writes in, I have been actively working in some area of the web industry for the last 12 years, currently 30 years old, and to have my dream job as a director for a great company. I've always had hard I've always had times of feeling burnt out and needing to take a break over the years. Now, with a young family, house, hobbies, etc., I find that these seasons are turning from weeks to months. Any tips on how to break out of the rut? How do you guys continue to stay excited about the industry and furthering your knowledge and skill sets? This is interesting. I would say, Chris, we are both life learners.
Life learners.
Do you ever get stuck in a rut, kind of sick of web stuff, and then you're like, and how do you break out of that?
I do, but I don't think I suffer from it as badly as some people do. I my enthusiasm usually stays pretty strong, and I think it's because I get to cheat and that I do lots of, you know, I get to work with my friends and I get to travel to conferences and I get to work on fun projects that are of my own choosing and stuff. And I just am very lucky in that way. But I think Blake is in a very common place. I hear this kind of a lot from people, is that they you know, burnout is common, and it's not just like a little bit of, or permanent, you know, there's lots of different kinds of burnout. There's just like the, you know, screw this place, I'm out burnout. There's the kind of like, I'm just not feeling productive lately, I'm not that excited burnout. There's the like, I'm feeling behind on my skills burnout, and I don't really care to level them up. So this transcends anything. This is not a web specific thing, and we can talk about it in the context of web, but I always, you know, think topics like this are kind of funny, you know, like, you know, butt warts in web design. You know, it's kind of like, I don't know, we talk about bigger problems sometimes in web, and forget that there's probably resources that you could reach out to, Blake, that have nothing to do with web. I mean, you could literally see a psychiatrist, you know, that would probably be helpful, you know. You could read books. There's books about this kind of thing that aren't necessarily web related, but they're just like, I'm feeling kind of blah in my life, or, you know, read the Happiness Project, or, you know, read something like that could possibly help. But yeah, you take it. What do you got, Dave?
Oh, I mean, I think, yeah, like getting burnout is part of it, right? The old like Protestant work ethic thing, it's like they pay you because it's called work or whatever. It's hard, it's boring, it's not what you want to do, but you get paid to do that to like support your life and your family. Yeah, I would say we probably cheated because, yeah, I work with two of my best friends and we, you know, like you said, conferences and stuff. I find like conferences are a pretty good break because you're still working, but you like, you translocate to somewhere, you're somewhere different. You like are talking to people you don't normally talk to. You kind of get a fresh perspective. I find that to be kind of fun. I've been playing around, not like intensely serious. I haven't filed papers to my company or something, but like I'm playing around with the idea of a sabbatical or something just to kind of like, you know, take something, learn something new, like without a huge obligation elsewhere. You know, I've been thinking about that.
It might be hard to learn that new thing if you, you know, wake up to a pile of emails that you feel obligated to answer and stuff, right?
Yeah.
So artificial freedom.
Yeah. Like set up artificial freedom. I know like academia does that a lot. And, you know, a lot of industries kind of have that sabbatical idea. A lot of freelancers even, you know, wasn't it like Sarah Parmenter, or I forget, but said, you know, you work so that you can take time off later. Like, so that's something to kind of think about. I don't know. I'm always like constantly learning. So I try to kind of do that, but there's definitely like times where you're just bummed.
I can see you feeling extra confused about it though, Blake, because you've been working in it a long time. So you have a young family, a house, you have hobbies, you have your dream job, and you're bummed. You know, it's like, I could see that being extra kind of confusing. You know, because it seems like you kind of got your life in order and you don't know what to do. It's like, you know, not to make it seem worse, Blake, but it may be a kind of a mental thing that you need.
Yeah,
you need outside help from. I wouldn't say, you know, learn Angular. That'll solve your problems, because it probably won't. Not in this case, you know.
Let's be honest, though. Angular fixes most in React. React will fix pretty much all your problems. Yeah, switch frameworks if you're feeling a little in a rut. That's a good way to feel like a fish out of water. Hobbies have helped me. I like my hobbies are always web related. So once I realized how kind of exhausting that is, like I got into comic books last year. I read like 6 books last year, which is way more than I've ever read in my adult life. So, deleting Twitter off your phone can actually work wonders for your life.
So. That I endorse, sir.
Yep.
All right, good luck, Blake. Mr. Blake. Right. Yep. Tom DeBruin writes in, we use Git for version control and follow the Git flow model mostly. We're getting into a bit of a kerfuffle, though, with our compiled CSS. We might have up to 3 developers working on the front end on different branches with SAS that compiles to CSS. Then boom, shake the room, we have a merge conflict. All the SCSS files are fine, but that compiled and compressed style.css, you know, the final output, is an abomination. So that it's what this is interesting is it sounds like what's happening is for whatever reason you only have merge conflicts on the CSS file. So he's kind of wondering what's the deal. He's read that some people just straight up git ignore the style.css files. You know, and then have it compiled in the server when you deploy. He's saying, I'm against that for some reason or another, and then doesn't say why you're against that. Tom, tell us why you're against that, because that's a very good way to do it. It's the style.css has no usefulness in your repo at all. It's totally useless. You know, it's not, it doesn't need to be there. It's not useful to see diffs against. It's just a compiled output kind of thing. That is truly, Tom, the way to go. If you can't do it, though, the fact that you said that you have no merge conflicts when the SCSS files are coming across each other, then who cares if there's a merge conflict? Just like pick one or the other, or just like whatever. Just who cares what happens in the merge conflicts? Just like resolve it, and then when you get it, because there was no merge conflicts on the SAS files, you know that that file is correct, and then just recompile it quick, and then. Commit the new style.css and be like, I don't know, I didn't care about the merge conflict, but I know that this is the most correct version. And like, you just don't have to worry about merge conflicts that much. Just like the last one right before you deploy. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess that's what I thought of.
No, I'm very much like, don't commit compiled things, let the computer compile that and spit that out. And because it's nice to be like, oh, I just pushed it up and I didn't have to do any sort of compile step on my server. But you kind of have like this, like you're running into this problem where if you send every time somebody saves the compressed style, it'll be a merge conflict. So, because it's just one line of CSS basically. Unless you wanted to change how your CSS compression, like to output style nested, that might save you some merge conflicts. But that would be the only way to get around that. So, isn't there like is nested like where it's like it's pretty compact, but it's not compressed? Isn't there a level of compression?
There's 4 levels, and whatever. There's like the extreme one that everybody uses because it's pretty well compressed, or you use nested, which I think is the least kind of.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe it's expanded as the one. There's like 4 levels. I don't know why you'd pick the in between middle two, like ever, but
ever. Yeah.
You might pick the
compact,
least compressed
compact.
One. Oh, compact. Yeah, whatever.
There's compressed. Compact, and then whatever, nested and crud. I can't read documentation. Never mind. Sorry, somebody will have to read documentation. Anyway, I wouldn't do that. I would just quit committing it and figure out a way to do it on the server. So, a post commit hook. So,
you only have to worry when
you deploy,
right? that like, or if there's a merge conflict with the actual SAS file, you have to be really careful with. But if you never have merge conflicts with those, then you know at least the actual code that you're writing is safe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And yeah. SAS, like breaking up into partials with SAS helps merge conflicts for your system, because like the more files, the chance that two people are working on the same file goes down quite a bit. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right.
Next. Going to a sponsor quick. I'm going to tell you about Wes Boss's book. The URL we'll send you to here is sublimetextbook.com. Pretty much nailed it with the URL there, Wes. Pretty good job. I know kind of a lot of us switch around back and forth and stuff, but I've been a Sublime user for a long time. I bet it's probably maybe, my guess is, the most popular code editing software there is in web at the moment. People like it quite a bit. I like it. I use it every day. In fact, my rescue time tells me it's the app that I spend the most time in every single week, week after week, which is good for me because that means I'm being productive. Anyway, Sublime Text is a code editor, and it's a very powerful one, and there's lots of cool stuff that you can do with it. Lots of cool stuff that you probably know about, and probably a lot of stuff that you don't know about that Wes can teach you about in this book that you buy, and it's really worth checking out, I think. It's kind of like here's this plugin that you haven't heard of that's awesome. You have this plugin that you heard of that isn't awesome, and it's to geek out a little bit, you know, it's to like make your Sublime Text look cooler than your friends. But really, there's a lot of actual productivity and stuff in here. And I always get a little jealous, you know, when you go to a conference, you watch somebody like blasting away on their computer, you watch a screencast of Paul Irish doing something fancy or whatever. You get a little jealous of how other nerds are using their computer. This is the kind of stuff, those tricks that kind of make you fly around a little faster, edit code a little better, help you make less mistakes and stuff. You're probably not getting as much out of Sublime Text as you think you are. So this book can level you up that way. So go to sublimetextbook.com. The coupon code is shoptalk for $11 off of it. If you hate it, there's 100% money back guarantee. So that's pretty sweet. I know Wes. I've met him at a conference. He gave a talk about Sublime Text, and the whole freaking conference was buzzing about it, because they're like, oh my God, did you know that you could do all this stuff with Sublime? I had no idea. Even me as a Sublime user, I'm like, dude, nice.
When you see somebody use Sublime and they're good at it, or any like code editor, but like they have hacks, like finger hacks. Oh, yeah. It's so amazing. It's just, mm-hmm. you're just like, I don't know how to code because they are so fast. And so I watched Yuna give a talk like that about Sublime recently. And she's just like, bing, bonk, bing, bonk. You just hit Command Shift D R P F 9 and it makes websites. So good luck.
And speaking of watching, it's a book, but there's 20 videos that come with it as well. So you can watch as well. Pretty sweet, Wes. Sublimetextbook.com and coupon code shoptalk. Let's talk some more. Let's do some talking.
All right. Talk some shop. Here we go. Chris House writes in, how should I handle the wp-config.php file when deploying a WordPress site? I use Beanstalk and I'm working alone. I'm struggling with this because there are essentially three different versions of the wp-config: local, staging, production. Should I put it in git ignore and just manually create it on the staging and production servers? It seems like there's a better way than that.
No, that's the way. Definitely git ignore your WP config file. I can't imagine what kind of change you would make to that locally that you would want to be deployed to either your stager or production server. There's like keys and stuff in it that you would want different on those things. There's database connection information that will definitely be different between those three things. Like, I could see the danger of accidentally pushing something up to a server that it's just bad news. I would just definitely git ignore that thing and just hand FTP edit it or SSH in and Vim edit it or whatever. Don't have that in your repo. That's no good. And then what if it is in your repo and then you made the repo public one day and you're like, oh, I should change some of that stuff in WP config, or I should delete that file now that this repo is public. But then you're like, well, it's still in your Git history, and then there's database connection information in your Git history, and it's like, ugh, just keep that sucker out of version control, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, that's the secure way, I would think, is there's like multi environment config plugins and stuff like that. Just do a switch statement, basically.
Oh.
Like if you're at mywebsite.dev, I'm looking at Studio 24 WordPress multi environment config GitHub repo, but like if case mywebsite.dev WP environment development case stage.mywebsite WP environment equals staging, and then
that's
you can
cool,
kind of like then you can request a different version of your WP config, like you just inject the environment. But I don't know, you know, I'm sure it caches at some level, like in it, but does that now create a whole loop for every operation, you know?
Probably.
Like that's, I don't know.
If you change things, can you be sure that the cache breaks and stuff? It's always fun to just throw a new level of caching in weird places on your website. Not going to regret that.
Because you're going to have to like throw in a host name. I know how Rails would do it. Like you set a server level variable, like you set environment equals production or whatever. And that's probably the quickest way, but I don't know. Then you're going to have to you're going to have to set that up, you know, figure out how you set that up on the server at some point. So you might as well just FTP up the right config file. I think that's what we're doing for Shop Talk. We don't save a config file. So, and we use Beanstalk too. So there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Let us know in the comments if we're doing that wrong. Thank you.
It has definitely bitten me in the past where I forgot in my young days. Where I would just put everything in the repo and I would push changes to WP config and it would take down my whole site. And I felt embarrassed and stupid about it until I was like, okay, that's coming out of the repo forever. Yeah. Clint Bush writes in, GitHub has always been a standard for developers for an online code portfolio, which it's kind of true, right? It's not always nice to send that along when you're applying for a job. However, I like CodePen much better. Oh, thank you. Clint, it seems to have a great user base. How do you decide which platform to use, or should I focus on a platform for code bits? I just wanted to, you know, put this in there to kind of clarify. I run CodePen. CodePen is not in the. It's I do sometimes say it's nice to have a CodePen portfolio, you know, an account on CodePen, because you do kind of have a portfolio there. It's kind of a resume. I mean, you know, it's codepen.io/your username is kind of a shows off the things that you've built and that you like and links to your other things. It can kind of be a thing like that, that, you know, in the same way you might pass along your GitHub portfolio to a job, you could do that with your CodePen one too, a little less known probably by hiring people, but maybe that will get better one day. But anyway, GitHub is source control. You know, it's this is where you code and you put code as part of version control. And CodePen really has no concept of version control. You know, maybe that will get better over time, but they're really very different products. And that's just kind of the one similarity, maybe, is this idea of an online portfolio. But neither of them truly are an online portfolio. They're just kind of the proof that you write code. But you don't even have to choose between them. They're not really competitors in that regard. You know, CodePen's more like you write code and you can see it as you build it. And GitHub is for version control for your code. So they're different, and you don't really have to make that choice, Clint. He does go on to say, secondly, for blogging, should I choose a platform like CodePen or kind of do my own thing? And I just put that in there to kind of clarify that, yes, we do have a blogging feature on CodePen. It's free. Everybody gets a blog when you sign up for CodePen. You don't have to use it, but if you feel like it, you can. And we built it because it's kind of it does a lot of things that make writing about code easier. It's a lot easier to inject chunks of code. You can blog in Markdown. You can insert pens really easily, which are little demos of code that you've made. It's just kind of convenient, and we built it because we saw people kind of writing about what they were building within pens. We're like, we could probably make that a better experience. Lots of people are now using it to write about code or really write about anything you want. We don't care what you write about there. But you know, and, you know, not to go on too long of a thing about this is I'm a fan of doing your own thing as well. I have my own blog. I always will have my own blog. I believe in owning your own data and being careful about that. I'm a big believer in that. I use CodePen blogging sometimes to share little one-off stuff that just don't really make sense on my own blog, or I'll publish it in both places. Jeffrey Zelbin had a post about this recently where he was talking about, you know, some people were like, oh my God, I can't believe you'd blog on Medium. You know, you're giving away your content to somewhere that you don't know will stick around, or what does it want to do with your content? He's like, eh, you know, like I've ran a list apart for a long time. Some people choose to write for a list apart because it has a different audience and it reaches different people and it doesn't lock your content there. You can put it on your own blog as well. And he's like, I put stuff on Medium just for that same reason. He ends up putting it on his own blog that he owns anyway too. You're of course welcome to do that on CodePen. You just might reach a different subset of people with your writing if you put it on CodePen as well, and get the comment system for free and all that stuff. So it's kind of like you don't really have to make that choice again, Clint. You can do your own thing and put it on CodePen if you want, or just use it on CodePen, or just do your own thing. You can kind of make those choices on your own. Sorry, I didn't mean to make that a big ad spot for CodePen, but you know, Clint wrote in. And,
yep. I have a designer friend, Julia. She is using CodePen as her like design portfolio, like because she's now coding her design. So, you can totally use it as a portfolio. Just whatever you want, really. People use Dribbble as a portfolio, you know. So, I mean, you might as well like leverage it if it makes sense to you. If it shows what you're in, CodePen's really great to show your thinking. I think
there's
that's
another interesting like way that this factors in is sometimes you don't really have a choice if people think of it as your portfolio or not. I mean, you can make the choice in your head that you want Dribbble to be part of your design portfolio, and then you might just be like, oh, hey, Julia, I looked at your Dribbble profile and saw some of the work you did. Like, I made the choice to look at her work there, and then it, you know, then now I know more about her and her work. So like, it doesn't really matter what her choice in her head was about it. Like, it is your portfolio.
Yeah,
I looked at it and I saw your work. So,
yeah, you did. You did not choose your portfolio. Your portfolio chose you.
Yes. Yes.
And then, blogging though. I mean, man, it like we should just make a shop talk stance. Like, it doesn't matter where, just effing do it. Is that a good
I like that, but it's like, you would help yourself a little bit in thinking about not losing that data. Like if Steve, yeah. You don't have to trust us implicitly. You know, do like Dave, have a little Jekyll site yourself, or keep that stuff. Not that I'm implying that you shouldn't trust us. You absolutely should. We're not going to do anything weird with it. We're not going to get rid of your content. You can trust me, but I like the idea of owning your own data as well. But like Dave says, write. The important part is write, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's let's use an analogy, like driving a car. It's maybe more fun if you own your own vehicle, but like you don't have to. You can rent a car or like use somebody else's car. It's fine. But like, yeah, I mean, when you have your own car, your own blog, then you just break things on purpose or totally by accident, and then you have to fix them. And then so there's some more learning you get to learn by blog ownerships.
Yeah, and the danger of it all, you know. It's one thing if we tell somebody, you should absolutely have your own blog, and they go through it and they struggle through it and they write a couple of posts on WordPress, but life gets in the way and they don't take care of it, and there's an exploit for WordPress and their posts get damaged in the database full of spam or something. There's like when you own your own data, you also have to be the shepherd of your own data too. So there's kind of two sides to that sword.
Yep. Yeah. No, like if CodePen gets hacked, God forbid, like that's CodePen's
problem. It's a disaster,
problem.
But we'll fix it.
Yeah, that's CodePen's problem, not your problem. But like if your site gets hacked and it's becomes a spam farm, mm-hmm. That's your problem. So sometimes it's your server's problem, but mostly it's your problem. So anyway, hey, hopefully that helped. Pew, 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 pew. That was a gun. Sorry. Next question. Steve Engert writes in, I'm redesigning and re-engineering an organization's website from scratch. I have clear design goals, but want to show objective engineering gains as well. What are your best metrics to compare for before and after a redesign? Page size and load time are obvious, but what other ones should I be thinking about?
Great question, Steve. This is fun. So you're redesigning a site and you have design goals. Design, are those, you know, match the brand better and stuff, or hopefully there's some UX goals and stuff in there too, you know, have users be able to more clearly find things. And those are great goals to have when redesigning a site. But it sounds like you already have those. You're thinking of some, you called them engineering gains, but I guess, and then went to list like speed things, but you can certainly have during a redesign goals like that, you know, like less code, or, you know, a cleaner repo, or in your case, some speed metrics. So yeah. The overall page weight is a great one. Load time is a good one. One that is often said recently is kind of that perceived page load, probably more important than either of the two that you referenced, is like, how fast does the page look like it loads? Mm-hmm. Right? What else you got?
That would be good. Like, lines of code have you used csstats.com? Maybe it's css-stats. Sure. Or
this kind of is how many colors there are, and it does that type of stuff, right?
Yeah, like I can do daveruber.com.
Your longest selector.
Like, I have 54 style rules, 58 selectors, 136 declarations, like 11 font sizes. That's a lot for my website. I need like two. So it's like, it really like audits your consistency and your kind of stupidity. I really think it's really good. So stuff like that, like pulling up these metrics and saying like, you know, is it better? Like, did we make something better than before? And kind of just, maybe you have a whiteboard that you scribble these numbers on, but that would be a really good thing, because lines of code and number of selectors, that's all complexity, you know, that's a representation of complexity. So that if you reduce complexity, it'll be easier to maintain, blah, you know, that should help you out and help your organization out. Basically, you're printing money. And I've noticed when I did like a RWD bloat post on my blog. Again, I'm like citing my blog. And I noticed a really significant, like just cleaning up my CSS dropped my speed index like 300 points, which is like significant. Just refactoring. So in terms of that, like you can even watch your speed index go down if you're doing things right. So I would recommend that as well. So like, how clean, like, and well maintained is your CSS, and then how, like,
yeah, well, speed index speed we just index. Didn't mention. That's just a good, that's a fun one to just, because it's a number, you know, that's fun. Mm-hmm.
It's a number. Yeah. Page speed insights I really like too. They give you page speed insights. They give you like basically a grade ranking from 0 to 100 on how well your site loads on mobile and desktop. This is good for SEO. And then they also have like UX rules, which you can pass through.
Yeah. It's just like, how big are your tap targets and stuff?
Like, did you consider mobile tap touch targets and stuff like that? I'm actually not seeing it. I just ran my site through it. I don't see it right now, but maybe I don't have a flag. So I don't know.
That's pretty cool. So those are performance goals. You have design goals, but there are, you know, there's lots of other type of goals that we kind of mentioned too, that, you know, code cleanness. Maybe you are moving from not having a style guide to having one, and stuff like that. But yeah, those are pretty measurable ones. I think we've had an advertiser on before from speedcurve.com. Maybe you just sign up for that and put your site in there. That's full of metrics. So check that out.
Dude, that's full of metrics. And you can compare against your competitors, which is kind of... That's
I wonder if you could compare
too.
Your staging site versus your live site.
Oh, I bet you totally could, huh?
Yeah.
And they had to run every day against a beta. So I would do that. That's got... They just hired Steve Souders, right? So, like...
Yeah, crazy good hire. Wow.
So that's picking up steam. And those would be my... CSS, like, complexity, getting... However you want to measure that, I think do that and then page speed and whatever. Like, I like page speed insights and speed index. Those are my two favorite stats. So, all right. Next question. Shall we go on?
Of course we should. Jonathan Cuthbert writes in, how did the trend of photoshopping your face into an astronaut's helmet start? I see this in a lot of profile pictures. I'm considering joining the craze, but I'd like to know the full history before jumping in. Is there something that I'm missing? I don't see it as much anymore these days, but I think it wasn't at that whole future-friendly thing.
Futurefriend.ly or futurefriendlyweb.com.
And was it like a click of people, or was it like, here's a Photoshop, here's a helmet, Photoshop yourself into? I think there was a real helmet, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think there's a real helmet, and they had like a real party where they hung out, and then there's a real under signums on the website. It's just a manifesto, that the idea that your website works, is built, you know, progressively enhanced upward to work on future devices that we don't know about, you know. And the classic example, I think they did it at an event apart, right, is they brought up TechCrunch, which was a big future-friendly kind of built site, and they brought it up on a watch that didn't exist.
And that's making the rounds at conferences, that little video.
So it's like, surprise, did you know a 240-pixel wide watch existed 10 years ago or 3 years ago when you were building your website? No, you didn't. That's okay. Like, now they do. And if you built it future friendly, it works on that. You know, does your website work on the HoloLens really well, where you can like size a browser window to the size of your wall? You don't know unless you built it future friendly. So that's kind of where it comes from, I believe. That could be totally
Kind of famously Brad Frost had it as his avatar for a long time, and probably everybody at the bottom of that list at one time at least used the helmet for a little while. I don't think most of these people have probably moved on from the helmet. Not that they disagree with what they wrote here, but just, you know, everything gets old over time, including having an avatar with a helmet on there. I don't think that they, even though you didn't go to this party, you can do whatever the heck you want, man. If you want to Photoshop your head into a space helmet because you agree with future friendly web, I think they'd be glad to have you. Cool. That's the history a little bit. There is a URL we can put in the show notes, futurefriendly.something. Or just Google futurefriendlyweb.com. That's what it is. Okay, that's Brian Cogsgard, did you pull up this? I know we didn't talk about audio.
I brought it up, and I'm going to load it now. Hopefully nothing else loads.
Brian's a bit of a WordPress dude.
Yeah, that's good. So this question is either 24 seconds long or 24 minutes long. Let's listen.
Hey, guys. I learned web development and templating through WordPress, like many other people. With the coming WordPress REST API, I'm looking to play around and learn another method for front-end development that pulls site data from the WordPress REST API's JSON output. And therefore, I don't have any back-end prerequisites. If you could go completely greenfield with no client requirements, what route would you most want to take to learn a new thing? Thanks.
All right.
Pretty cool. I had a post on CSS Tricks about this WordPress REST API. Not that you need to read that. You could probably just go to the WordPress REST API website and see it. But the point is that as soon as this plugin is installed and activated, it might be core someday. I don't know. I think that's where it's headed, but it's not yet. For now, you need to install this plugin. But as soon as you've done that, you have a whole bunch of endpoints for your WordPress site now, you can essentially, you know, write queries in the URL, essentially. You can pretty much get whatever you want to just through special URLs, and it will return stuff in JSON, which is pretty cool, which means that you no longer necessarily then need to build a website. Like, like probably it's mostly for use like within your otherwise WordPress website, but there's people theorizing, including Brian here, that you could just use WordPress as just the content farm and not have a theme at all, not really use WordPress's front end at all, but just digest its JSON data for something totally different. You know, make a Ember site or something that digests the data that was created in WordPress. You could do that, right?
Yeah, you wouldn't even have to. You could just hit posts like /all, and then you wouldn't even need to get, I don't know, you wouldn't have to do like WordPress templating. You could just bring your own templating language. So,
which would be like handlebars or whatever. I would think, Brian, that this is territory for React, Angular, Ember, not another backend frame, not Ruby, not a Rails project. Yeah, because JSON is like a front-end data transfer format, kind of. Not that it can't be useful for backend stuff too, but you need to make an AJAX request for this data probably, right? You wouldn't have Rails. You wouldn't build an app that required a different server to ask for JSON data and then serve up a Rails template with that data. I guess maybe you could, but something about that feels...
You could. Often. I mean, you could have like you could have WordPress, some remote WordPress server as the brain of your application. And then you could do the kind of Karen McGrain style, like your website is just a client that talks to the brain. Or
it
your
seems
iPhone
to make
app
more sense as a JavaScript app than a backend app, though, doesn't it, or not? Or would you be comfortable writing a backend app? Because you just wouldn't get any of the like active record action going. Like it just doesn't know anything about the data. I guess that doesn't matter.
Well, I think it's basically a Rails competitor, basically, is what the REST API is. So so you could really do whatever you want. I don't know. I've been looking at, I spent the whole day like yesterday looking at React Native. Have you heard or seen this, Chris?
Yeah, you can build native apps in it. People are pretty hand clappy about it.
Yeah, people are pretty stoked. But it's basically you like write React. I'm not even going to call it HTML or JavaScript because it's totally React. It's its own kind of language UI or like DSL, Des Moines specific language. And you write these like templates in your JavaScript and then it spits out a like iPhone app, like compiled to Xcode kind of thing, like transpiled, I guess you might say. But all native animations, everything like that. So it's pretty darn cool. So that would be kind of cool. Like in the idea that your WordPress API could power that is kind of cool too. Like you just write a little bit of React that connects to a remote WordPress and all of a sudden you have an app, you know. That said, here's what I will caveat. It's weird. A lot of WordPress sites, I think, are built for content, so they don't necessarily need this API for, you know, apps. Like, the web is the API, you know? But maybe that's not true anymore. I don't know. So, like, does CSS Tricks need an app? I don't think so, necessarily. Maybe you're building...
No, absolutely not. That's a can of worms. I'm not just going to say, oh, that's true. Because then you get the persistent login, which is nice. That's one of the big reasons for appness, I think, you know? Mm-hmm. Anything that I have to, like, that's a web app, but I have to log in every time I use it?
Nope. No, I forget to do that.
Brian, Ember is the most exciting one to me. I think that would be fun to build a little Ember app that somehow sucks in WordPress. I mean, just randomly, like if I'm going to pick a thing, that would sound like a fun thing to do.
We're like building a little app on the side. I'll probably talk more about it later in Shop Talk, but I might build a little like native client using Ionic, which is a cool little framework. Oh,
go Wisconsin.
What is it? It's like HTML or Angular, and then it's like, but then you can compile to iOS and Android in like it'll translate, like the tab bar on the bottom of your iOS app will translate to a tab bar, which is at the top of an Android app. So kind of cool.
That rules. And it's like Bootstrap-ish, right? It has all these components that are kind of ready to go. So
yeah, it's basically getting
very popular. I'm happy for them.
They've
been at it for a long time. You know, this is not just like they came out of nowhere with this. That's what I like about them is that they've been hoofing it with this thing for a long time.
It's not junior. It's not like a website. Like it has a little more animation. Like it's really pretty convincing. So I'm gonna actually probably start there before I go to like a React Native or even a full.
That's true. And this thing
Swift
could certainly suck down WordPress JSON API too. Remember we had Rick Blaylock on a long time ago too. He works on one of these little phone things that could probably suck down JSON too.
I was listening to Ushahidi on the Responsive Web Design podcast, Sophie Shepard, and they're building this app that has to target Kenya, right? Like a website that has like Kenya as a target. But maybe if they could just spit out JSON and then a little native client sucks that up. Maybe that's a possibility. I don't know. That's what's interesting me is starting to make native clients in JavaScript and stuff. So anyway, hopefully that helps.
Fantastic. It looks like how are we doing here? We're at about an hour. We should probably wrap. But there's one left on the list, so maybe we'll just do it super, super quick.
All right.
Solil?
Yep. Oh, no, yeah.
What are your thoughts on how you should serve Retina images? They linked to a blog post from 2014 about some ways that you can do that. That somebody pointed. I mean, we could put a link in the show notes, but it's kind of like they're referencing Retina.js, which must be some library that like auto swaps sources or something for pictures to swap it to a 2x version or something. And then it's kind of listing some kind of old school ways to handle Retina images. But these days, this is kind of talked about differently. So what they want to know is like, what's the way to do it? And what the way to do it, there's a like, you know, I hate to be this cut and dry about it, but there's pretty much one way. It's to use the new syntax that actual browsers are supporting. It's use the picture element or use image with source set, probably in most circumstances, especially for Retina images, like you mentioned in your question here. Use image with the source set property. Browsers will natively support that. Firefox rolled out today, I think, with their initial support of it. And it's been in Chrome, and the new Edge browser is going to be supporting it. So it's like, this is the way to go. There's no more weird hacks anymore. Don't be trying to manipulate cookies or figure out server side ways to do anymore. Use this. Use picture fill temporarily if you need to have it work in older browsers. But there's pretty much just the one way now, right?
Yeah, resolution switching is source set. There, you can. You can get real deep. Jason Grigsby has a 6-part article on responsive images over at Cloud 4. It is Cloud 4. I was like, oh my God, I got that wrong. He has a 6-part series on how to do responsive images. So it is complicated. No shame in asking, but source set is pretty awesome because you can just do img src set equals my image space 1x, comma my retina image space 2x. So pretty awesome way to do things there. So that's really the best way to get things up and going.
It sure is. It is image source set, and we can probably drop an article in the show notes that'll get you there. I have a CSS Tricks post that will get you going on that, and not to mention all the stuff from the RICG, which will also get you going. The Responsive Issues Community Group. They've changed their name.
I'm looking at the source set attribute on Can I Use, and it's with when IE Edge comes out, it'll be every browser except Opera Mini, basically. So
Which kind of does its own cool stuff, doesn't it? Or not? Or is that Opera? Yeah, Mini does its
own.
Yeah,
Opera Mini might proxy compress images for you. So that's, you know, whatever they do. I hate it. It's such a black box. This is my least favorite browser. Anyway, but people use it because they want to save money. So, So there was some, all of this comes down to like saving money, right? Like, I'm dragging this out. Sorry. I apologize. But like, I saw this thing, like I think it was Christian Heilman was tweeting, to get 10 megabytes, it was like £20 or something in the UK, maybe £12. So $15 US for 10 megabytes, which is like 5 web pages now, because the average web page is two megs.
Right.
Can you believe $15 for 5 web pages?
That pretty is wild.
Freaking astronaut bucks, man. That is crazy. Anyway.
Opera Mini serves a lot of stuff. I saw a stat for them that was like, this is how much data they push that they somehow made public. But that was the compressed data. And sometimes they compress up to 90% of size down. So you really take that number and times it by 10, which is a pretty freaking significant chunk of traffic.
If you're looking at 5 web pages or 50 web pages, man, the situation, like, I know why you'd use Opera Mini.
Yeah, anytime we talk about an order of magnitude, good times.
Big deal. Anyway, well, I think we must bid adieu. Pew, bazooka.
Very good. Really Chris. Nailed it.
We're done. Hey, thanks everybody for listening to another episode of Shop Talk Show. Be sure to rate this up in your podcatcher of choice. That's how people find out about the show. That's how I buy diapers for my kid. So we really appreciate that. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. If you hate your job, go over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a really good one. And
yeah, please do that. And that's been successful. Some folks, you're doing that. And if you're looking for a person, do it too. It sounds like some of you guys are looking for jobs on there and worked out. One of them is a man named Stephen Garrity wrote to me today and said that we posted their job on there for a company in Canada called Silver Orange, which is a cool little agency. I think it's where Daniel Burka worked like way back in earlier in his career. And they got a good number of applications, not an overwhelming amount of them, but they're 40, he said, but they're all very highly qualified and quality people, which is good. They conducted some interviews and found a great person, and she's been working for us for a week now, she said, and we're delighted. Money well spent, thanks. So it's doing its job. It's connecting people, hiring with people looking.
There you go.
That's a nice quote. Anyway, I guess I should do the thing where I go shoptalkshow.com.